This is Zach Kyler from the CSIS Energy Program. I'm here with Feridun Fisharaki, Chairman of FACTS Global Energy, Frank Verastro, Senior Vice President and Schlesinger Chair for Geopolitics at CSIS, and David Pumphrey, Senior Associate at CSIS, former head of the CSIS Energy Program, and former Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Energy at the Department of Energy.
We're going to talk a little bit about oil and gas markets, starting out with a question for Feridun on Iran. We've talked, you know, there's been a lot of talk in Washington especially about what Iran's reentry into global oil and gas markets is going to look like. On the oil side of things, though, there's a relatively tight market and contracts are tied up. And on the gas side of things, you've expressed some skepticism that Iranian LNG will be coming online anytime soon. So how do you expect Iran to reenter oil markets? And then on the gas side of things, do you anticipate that further down the line, Iran will start exporting LNG, or do you expect it to use its gas to export, to generate and export electricity, start exporting condensate, or use the majority of it for reinjection?
I think the Iranian oil production capacity, which existed pre the sanctions in 2012, can be easily reattained. That volume would be about 1.2 million barrels per day above the exports, above the volume which Iran has been exporting. So that can be generated very quickly within a 2-3 month period of time. However, generating the capacity doesn't mean generating actual production. The market can absorb only about half or less than half of that without interrupting the flow and creating a price war. So the Iranians intend to sell 500,000 barrels per day. Two-thirds of it is crude and one-third of it is condensate to certain markets, and they have pretty much pre-sold it. So this volume will be in the market by February, March of next year. Insofar as gas is concerned, the LNG markets are saturated. The Iranians are not after creating something which is already past its prime time. I think the idea of electricity generation and exports is not really on the cards either. What they will do is they're trying to export gas by pipeline to neighboring countries, specifically to UAE, to Oman, and to Kuwait. This is, I think, where the heart of the gas export business will be.
And Frank, did you have any comments on that?
So I would just say I agree with Farron, and I think in Washington circles, people forget the distinction between liquids, condensate, and crude oil. And crude oil, they tend to lump it all together as crude oil, and it's not. And there are different markets. I totally agree. I think there's a lot of condensate production that's going to come out of South Pars, right? They have gas and oil and floating storage that would be available. But when you look at the makeup of the current market, there's no room to absorb 700,000 or 800,000 barrels a day. So I think it's going to be slow and gradual over a period, a couple hundred thousand barrels a day.
And then it seems that the geopolitics of exporting to the UAE is relatively different than the geopolitics of exporting gas to Oman. Where do you see, how far down the line do you see exports to the UAE? How contingent do you think that is?
I think the overwhelming logic of exporting to UAE is so great. The gas fields between the two countries is less than a kilometer away. One side is depleted, one side is full, so they're going to connect one to the other. It is a matter of time. I think decisions will be made in 2016, latest by 2017. That will happen. The Oman deal is already a done deal. We just need the sanctions to be lifted. And it requires several hundred million dollar infrastructure. It's not something which can happen tomorrow. But the UAE can happen right away.
And Frank, do you see the economics overriding any political considerations with exports to the UAE?
No, I think the UAE makes sense. I also think that for reentry into Europe, Total and Eni are real interesting because if they can court the Iranians and do some work upstream, they also have downstream opportunities in Europe to come back. So it's not all just competition for Asia.
And Dave, did you have any comments on that?
I just think the entry of potential entry of Iranian gas is very interesting issue given the complexity of gas markets globally. And there's been, for many years, the thought that they would try to access the European market. But I think, as Feridun's pointed out, that this will be incremental. And right now, moving into that market is going to be very difficult. So moving out in a way that is incremental and steps and moving that gas forward, it makes a lot more sense than trying some kind of major entry into markets that are further away.
I think one thing to add is that there will be some LNG from Iran, but it is based on the projects where investments has already been made or using the assets in other countries. So Iran would be a minor player, maybe 8 to 15 million tons in joint venture with other players. It is not going to be a major cornerstone of the policy, given the fact that Iran is really a gas province rather than oil province. But the exports of LNG is a lot more complicated, and this market's all saturated.
I wanted to ask Ferdinand a question, actually two related on the gas side. So one is we've heard reports about mercaptan's issues, some of the condensates, and so the sour issue, what do you do with it? And then the second piece is that to avoid sanctions in the future, the notion of using nuclear and natural gas for power generation and exporting electricity to neighboring countries, not even the U.S. would want to interrupt electricity flow to neighboring countries. Thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the issue of mercaptan is a big issue because the Iranian condensate actually smells very bad. Yeah. And the odor is so bad that you can't stay near it. The Qataris have the same condensate. Because they have access to U.S. technology, they've been able to deodorize right. it. The Iranians are now using some techniques to deodorize it, but it's hard to sell. If you look at the 60 million barrels of, let's say, floating storage from Iran, 55 of it is condensate. Okay. And actually, as far as I know, there is zero crude in that. Condensate and fuel oil is what they have in there, but they don't really have any crude because they can't shut in the condensate. They can't shut in the fuel oil. Increasing use of gas has meant that the power sector has moved fully to gas, and so they have all the fuel oil left over, the 200,000 barrels per day of surplus fuel oil that they have to sell. So the calculations have gone in this fashion. Because of this problem with condensate, the Iranians have made a policy decision to pretty much use all the condensate at home by splitting it.
Splitter investments.
So splitting either by making gasoline and or by making naphtha. So the plans is that by 2020, they will not export any condensate, but they will do it. They will be exporting refined products in its place. So in a way, that sort of is going to be the cornerstone of the policy. In terms of electricity exports, I see and hear a lot about it, but certainly the oil minister, energy minister in Iran, oil minister, are not keen on this. So I don't know where the idea came from. Okay. I actually see no interest on their part to use cheap gas to create electricity to give it neighbors. They'd rather give the gas and get the cash.
And I think the other question that seemed to come up with the electricity exports is the reliability of electricity is a very sensitive issue between countries. So who in that region will want to make their linkage on electricity, yeah. which is so vital to another country, if they could actually take the gas yes. and generate their own electricity.
Because so they I think have control over it.
Yes, yeah. precisely. Yeah. So I think it's something that, while it may be an idea that sometime in the future mm-hmm. when better relations are in place and you have a way to,
it makes
to
sense,
move it.
But it's not practical.
Right. Well,
I think that there the politics become very difficult.
Yes, indeed.
So going back to the issue of condensates, you've said that oil and gas markets are something like second cousins, not brother and sister, not siblings. Does the competition of condensates with refined petroleum products change the relationship between oil and gas markets, and might it change the relationship more in the future?
Well, the condensates are liquids which come from gas, but they look like oil, they walk like oil, they talk like oil. So they are a light oil. Mm. So you sell it today in the market at between $2 to $3 below or higher than the crude price. You do two things with condensate. You either blend it into the crude pool and becomes oil, lighter oil, or you put it in the petrochemical plants as a feedstock, or you split it, take the naphtha, and put it in the petrochemical plant. So all these options exist. The condensate production, it's very much like a crude production, but it depends on the gas production. So if you cannot sell the crude, you can shut it in the field. But condensate, you cannot shut in because you produce the gas, you have to produce this one. It's a byproduct, which makes it much more difficult to manage. And this is why the Iranians want to see if they can use it all at home. Now, in a condensate world, there are two big players, Iran and Qatar. U.S. is a huge player, but the U.S. condensate doesn't look like the condensate the market needs. The quality is not the same. It's not good for petrochemicals. So once the Iranians go out of the market, the Qataris will have a field day. They can say that the higher prices, they will have premiums, and the position becomes very important. I don't think that's the intention of the Iranians, but automatically this would make the condensate prices more valuable and the Qatari role more important.
Frank or Dave, did you have anything to add?
Well,
to
so one of the issues we actually have here is the variability of U.S. condensate. Like some of the stuff that's being produced in the Bakken is 50 degrees, some of it's 80 degrees. The issue on rail transport in the United States actually manifests this difference in a lot of different ways. So when you put oil in a pipeline, you have to meet pipeline specs. When you put oil in a tank car, you just fill it up. Right? And so some of the refineries were getting shipments of this variable oil, and as they put it through, they were finding operational problems because it all didn't perform the same, even though it was identified as condensate.
But one thing which is very interesting, you know, the U.S. has not officially opened condensate exports, but there is a formula that whoever wants to export can export. And so with this market being free, the past 5 months, the first 5 months of the year, data which is available, 84,000 barrels per day. It's not a big flood going out. It's because the quality of the U.S. condensate is not what the market is seeking. The quality of the Iranian condensate is what the market is looking for.
So there was an announcement by Xi Jinping about the creation of a Chinese carbon market. On the subject of the climate, you've said that you don't anticipate that Japanese natural gas demand is likely to increase. You think that it's more likely that Japan will increase its coal consumption to meet its baseload needs. Do you think that with a firm climate commitment, Japan might actually increase the proportion of its power generation from natural gas and the Japanese gas demand might increase, or do you think that that's unlikely?
I think the decision is already made in Japan. The issue really, Japanese electricity sector is heavily dependent on nuclear. So, you know, if there is a lot of nuclear, then they don't need much coal. But if there's less nuclear, they need more coal. The Japanese look at the baseload electricity supply to be coal and nuclear, not natural gas. They think natural gas comes from many places, is still not fully under their control, but nuclear and coal are within their control. So pretty much under any scenario, gas consumption would face limitations in Japan.
The other point I think that's important in the Japanese case is the efforts they've made post-Fukushima on energy conservation, energy efficiency, has really resulted in lower levels of need at the baseload level. So they can, as they return the nuclear, the amount of coal will be somewhat more limited, and they keep the gas in that mid-range. And it's not an economy that's growing that fast to drive up electricity baseload needs.
Yeah, Dave's point on demand and Faraday, too, is really important. In a growing market, you have room for renewables, increased coal, increased nuclear, and a lot more natural gas. In markets that are flat or declining, you start cannibalizing different fuels, and people have to make investments on what's available and what costs. It's hard to go to your board and say, let's spend a lot of money on this new technology or this new fuel source if there's a variable price on it.
I think another point, you'd mentioned the new announcement by the Chinese that they're going to go with a nationwide cap and trade program, but I don't know that any detail is out yet as to how that's going to work. And after the debate that we had in the United States on the methods and modalities of a cap and trade program, there are many ways to implement cap and trade programs that can give you different results. It really depends on how strong your cap is, how real the market is. And I don't think we've seen that yet. So to say that whether or not it's going to drive a natural gas demand is really too early, because there's so many other ways to implement these programs that we'll have to wait and see. It's an important development that they're saying they're going to go ahead, but it's important to wait and see what the details are.
So, Faraday, you've said that the likely increase in the likely availability of demand comes from not new demand, but old contracts ending and new contracts being written. Specifically in Japan, they have contracts coming up for renewal. Do you think that, you know, given demand constraints and given the competitive advantage that existing LNG exporters have in getting those, you know, new contracts for old demand, that new investment in LNG exports might be edged out? And if so, who do you see being, you know, the largest loser in that competition?
Well, you know, the replacement volume is important and it's large. And you can replace it either by those who have already bought, or you go to some people who are going to build brand new ones. So it makes sense that you go to the ones which have already bought it and would have it at hand. So I think that it's going to be difficult for any new project anywhere. But as long as the price of oil remains low, I think the U.S. projects are disadvantaged. And it's time that the U.S. projects take a breather because you can't create demand by increasing the supply. You just have to wait for the demand growth to come by itself and the replacement to take care of it.
Well, thank you very much, Faridun, Dave, and Frank. This has been really enlightening.
Thank you very much.